Okay, why don't we get started? My name is John Beck, and I'm a professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations here at Michigan State. But it is my immense pleasure to co-direct something called, on our campus and here in the community, Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, that looks at the intersection of work and culture broadly defined. It's a cooperative program between the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations Labor Education Program and the MSU Museum. Tonight, this program is under that overall umbrella, as well as being part of the MSU Library Colloquia series. This series actually is wonderful because of the fact that we record all of them, and they're available, and you can actually check them out on the MSU University Library catalog, and you can go back and listen to any of them over the period of the last few years that we've been recording. I think we have about 60 now or so, John, I think, is that right? The MSU Library Colloquia series is an absolutely wonderful thing run by Michael Rodriguez, who's standing in the back of the room trying to, right at this point, disappear the minute that I call out his name. And we all believe, and I'm looking around the room and seeing so many members of the community, we believe that MSU is a place where you belong. We believe that this is a place where, whether you're a student, a staff member, faculty member, administrator, or someone who lives somewhere in the surrounding area, families and friends, we believe that the intellectual life of the community is made better by all of us sitting together. Tonight, we're sitting together in relation to the 40th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, oh, by the way, let me first, I just heard it. First thing we want to do is make sure that our cell phones are on stun rather than on disintegrate. And it's always interesting to find out what ringtones people have, but it's also good if we don't have them interrupt. So tonight we have a panel of three great speakers who are going to help us understand different things about the iron ore trade, iron ore shipping, and shipwreck. And together, we're going to build an understanding not so much of what happened the night of November 10th, 1975, but of a lot of the different contextual things that one needs to understand about what brought us to be the center, frankly, of the steelmaking universe here in the Great Lakes states, both from a natural resources point of view, from a lake shipping point of view, and so forth. But before I get to introducing the panel, it is a commemoration, and it is a memorialization as well. You know that people have passed away in lake disasters for, frankly, centuries here in the Great Lakes, going back to the Griffin and all the way forward. But the Edmund Fitzgerald is the last time in the last 40 years when we've had a major lake disaster here in the Great Lakes. We cannot say that about all the decades prior to the loss of the Fitzgerald. We had the Daniel J. Morrell in 1966. We had the Carl Bradley in 58. And if you go back to probably the greatest loss of life in a single storm, the great winter storm of 1913, over 250 people passed, were killed in that lake disaster on multiple ships. Great Lakes Shipping has assumed a certain sacrifice of sailors, a certain sacrifice not only of sailors, but of workers caught up in the iron ore trade, iron ore mines in our native Michigan and also Minnesota, elsewhere. Not only miners, but dock workers. My family worked on the docks in Escanaba, where I'm originally from. And many people died on the docks when they were carried through the ore pocket, through the chute, and into the hold of ships, only to break their necks on the way down. This is the night when the Edmund Fitzgerald slipped beneath the waves. No one knows to this point why the Fitzgerald sank. Doesn't know the actual, what the last moments of that specific shipping disaster looked like. The only thing that we can walk away with is the name of the crew. for certain. We know where the ship rests. We have the longitude and latitude. But it's my responsibility right now to read the names of the crew, and afterward, to ask all of you to observe a moment of silence before we get on to the rest of our panel. So let me now read the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald in alphabetical order. Michael Armagast, and by the way, please, I have to tell you that whether or not I do a good job on their names is not unlike what I do with my own students the first week of class. It's always, unfortunately, not necessarily on target, but I hope that I do them honor. Frederick Becher, Thomas Benson, Edward Bingdon, Thomas Borgeson, Oliver Chapeau, Nolan Church, Ransom Cundy, Thomas Edwards, Russell Haskell, George Hull, Bruce Hudson, Alan Kalman, Gordon McClellan, Joseph Mays, John McCarthy, Captain Ernest McSorley, Eugene O'Brien, Carl Peckle, John Povich, James Pratt, Robert Rafferty, Paul Ripa, John Simmons, William Spengler, and Mark Thomas. Would you please join me in a moment of silence for the 29 lost on the Edmund Fitzgerald? Thank you. Let me say that the interesting thing about the crew is only one member of the crew was from the state of Michigan. As much as we, I think, have really taken the wreck as our own, the majority of the crew was actually from the state of Ohio, others from the state of Wisconsin, Florida, some from Pennsylvania, Minnesota. But only one from the state of Michigan, from St. Joseph, Michigan. One of the youngest, by the way, 23 years old, an oiler. But we do take the wreck as our own because of the fact that it lies off of Whitefish Point up in Lake Superior, actually, I think, in Canadian waters. And I think all of us have probably remember, as I do, where we were of men and women of a certain age when we heard that the Edmund Fitzgerald had gone to the bottom. So let me now introduce the three people who are on our panel. And we've asked each of them to do a mini TED talk, short, sweet, and to the point. And then what we are going to do, let me tell you how it's going to work tonight. I'm going to introduce the three of them together. They're going to come up each in turn and do a quick presentation on their topic. We are then going to open it to discussion, and hopefully you'll have questions that maybe they can answer, maybe people in the room can answer. The other day we were doing a presentation about Lake Shipping only to find out that there were experts in the room that knew far more than any of us did at the front of the room. So tonight we are absolutely just blessed to have three great presenters, three great folks who are going to be on this panel. In order of presentation, Michael Velbil is from the MSU Department of Geological Sciences, has been department chair in that department at various points in his academic career. Is an expert on top of everything else in terms of meteorites. So you can ask him two planet stories here tonight if you want to. But Michael has been asked tonight to talk about iron ore, which he'll do in a moment after I introduce the other two. Second speaker tonight is Peter Kakala. Peter and I have actually team taught at various points over our careers, and it's always been my pleasure to team teach with Peter. Peter is with the MSU School of Community Sustainability, but he used to be with what was called at that point the MSU Department of Natural Resources. And Peter really has staked out much of his career on transport economics, specifically looking at lake shipping. Last but not least on our panel tonight is Dean Anderson. Dean Anderson is the state archaeologist here in the state of Michigan. And Dean is familiar with things underground and underwater because he has responsibility for all of it in his life as state archaeologist. Many of you might know Dean from many of the controversies that he's been asked to speak to lately about the presence or non-presence of the Griffin, the earliest shipwreck in the history of the Great Lakes of great note. And if you really want to go for it, ask him questions about that later. But let's go with lake shipping and the Edmund Fitzgerald and everything else first. So, like I said, we're going to hear from the three of them, at which point we are all going to take these mics at the table and open it up for discussion at that point. So at this point, let me introduce Dr. Michael Belleville.
Thank you, John. It's a privilege to be here for this event and this occasion and this opportunity. When John contacted me about this, he gave me a couple required elements, a couple things that he expected that I would include, and I have included them in the flow of what I thought I would introduce in the way of the matter of the iron ore and the central question that I want to keep as kind of the theme in this presentation is this is true of any ore deposit, but why are the ore deposits where they are? Why are there certain places where we extract and exploit those resources, and why are those not elsewhere? And the theme I'm going to, or the explanation that I'll offer in relation to that questioning theme is that there are two necessary conditions for what we will later regard as an ore deposit to be present in a particular place: the physical and chemical and geological and biological conditions have to be right for forming that kind of material at a particular place, at a particular time. We know on Earth's environment now, Earth's surface, there are oceans and land, there are shallow oceans and deep oceans, there are mountains where there's going to be erosion, there are low places where there's going to be sedimentation. So any particular subset of all the possible phenomena only operates in certain places at certain times. And so the conditions that had to exist to form ore had to exist in a particular place at a particular time. And the second point is that material had to be preserved from subsequent geological processing, otherwise it would have been modified or destroyed. So those two themes of process are going to be involved in my discussion of the iron ore. And I made a timer setting for myself and forgot to start it. I'll penalize myself 1 minute for doing that. I'll make it 2 minutes, see how that works. Not real well. I'll try using the arrow instead of the pointer and staying here on stage. This is a nice, typical, relatively simple outcrop of what is called banded iron formation, the iron ore of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior region is banded iron formation. This is a photograph from Jasper Knob in Marquette. The jasper part is a silica-rich material, a lot like chert, vaguely like flint. It only takes a fraction of a percent of iron, oxidized iron, in a rock to turn it bright red. So there's less than 1% iron in the jasper, but the jasper is the red layers. And then because of subsequent geologic history, whatever the iron-rich layers were to begin with, they are now a fairly coarsely crystalline variety of an iron oxide mineral called hematite. And that's actually where the economic part is. It's in the silvery part, not the red-looking part that you would think is the rusty part. So the red layers are the jasper, and the gray and silvery layers are the recrystallized and now coarser than it originally was hematite, an iron oxide mineral. And these are chemical sedimentary rocks. They're material that precipitated out of an ancient ocean, settled to the bottom, and then became consolidated, turned from unconsolidated sediment into sedimentary rock. And then there was even more. You know, the rest they say is history. Well, there's even more history because it became ore. One slide with chemistry on it. All right, take a deep breath, and maybe I'll be done before you're done holding your breath. Iron has 26 protons. It's an atomic number of 26. That means that metallic or native iron has the same number of electrons. It's neutral, same number of positive and negative charges, evens out. The most common form of iron in Earth's crust is 2 plus iron. Same number of positive charges in the nucleus, but 2 electrons went away. That is called oxidation. And we'll have a reaction that shows that in just a minute. If one more electron goes away so that the imbalance of charge isn't 26 minus 24, that is to say plus 2, if it's 26 minus 23 electrons, because 3 electrons of the initial 26 were taken away, we get the one on the right, ferric iron. When 2 plus iron exists, it is soluble in water. It floats around in the water. It's a dissolved substance like magnesium on the periodic table. They're about the same size of ion. They're about the same charge. And so in an ocean that doesn't have any oxidants in it, that doesn't have any electron acceptors in it, iron will float around in this divalent state. It'll be a dissolved cation, like magnesium or sodium. But in the presence of oxygen and things that form easily from water, the iron oxidizes. The oxygens are the electron acceptor. Since they were the first one to be understood, that's why that electron transfer is referred to as oxidation. Anything can be an electron acceptor under the right circumstances, but we call the phenomenon always oxidation because the first one that was recognized was oxygen. Well, 3 plus iron immediately reacts with something else in the water to become rust. It stops being dissolved and comes out as mineral matter. This particular formula, the iron hydroxide, is the yellow or orange rusty material. And with just a little bit of driving off the water, that will dehydrate and form hematite, the mineral hematite, Fe2O3, with iron in its oxidized state. And hematite is the mineral form of the silvery layers in the banded iron formation. Now, it may not always have been hematite, but for many years, the explanation was it was deposited, it was precipitated as hematite, and this set of reactions like this were the set of chemical reactions that geologists and economic geologists and geochemists used to explain why do we have hematite and how would it, you know, in these kinds of abundances layered in with chemical sedimentary material. Well, when did this happen? I said the conditions have to be right for an ore deposit to form. They also have to be right at a certain time. The geologists, XY plots, a plot with a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. The horizontal axis, from your point of view, is that the present is off to your left of the screen, and you're looking back in time as the numbers, giga years, giga anna, billions of years. As you move to the right on these, your right on these diagrams, we're looking farther back into time. And between about 4 billion years, not long after the Earth formed, and about 1.5 billion years, there are certain intervals of geologic time, particularly here around 2.4 to 3 billion years old, when most of the banded iron formation on Earth formed. A little bit formed earlier, the last pulse of it is actually the pulse that's responsible for what we have in the Upper Peninsula. All right. The chemical conditions under which these accumulations of iron-rich sediment could form seem to, this is another diagram again with the same kind of x-axis, the present is at the left, you're looking back in time to the right, and the row here that is A is the long-standing standard geochemical model that goes with those chemical reactions that I showed a moment ago. And what it basically shows is that iron was soluble in seawater during this interval, and by about the last youngest, except for these weird ones here, banded iron formations, Afterwards, somewhere in here, it appears that the level of oxygen in Earth's atmosphere and circulating down into Earth's oceans through waves and foam and currents taking oxygenated water down to greater depths, it appears that the first major surge of that, the so-called great oxidation event of Earth's atmosphere ocean system, peaked about 2.4 billion years ago. Banded iron formations continued to form until about 1.8 billion years ago. And by that time, there was enough oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere that the 2 plus iron couldn't stay dissolved anymore. It was all oxidized. It was not possible for dissolved iron to be in the water anymore. And it had all precipitated out. The little bit that was going to be there was going to be in rust immediately and not be in a dissolved form that could precipitate as these layers consisting of primarily an iron-silicate combination of sediments. There are other geochemical models. Economic geologists want to understand something about the ancient environments because understanding what was going on geologically at the time the ore formed is a way of figuring out where else should we look to find more places where the conditions would have been the same. So there's an applied science side in economic geology to figure out why things formed, to look for other places where the same kinds of conditions might have existed. Well, of course, we have a model at any one time based on understanding. Once it became recognized that it was related to oxygen in Earth's atmosphere and ocean, pure scientists, not just applied scientists, got involved in it. And there are other models that involve other, oh dear, there are other models involving other electron acceptors. Here is what we'll do. There are other electron acceptors, and I just have to drop names. I have to do this. Just after my wife and I got married, somebody came to visit us to see if they wanted to be a graduate student at the same place where we were at graduate school. And that guy decided to come to graduate school at our place and at our university, and we overlapped for 1 year. And he came up with the currently prevailing alternative model for ocean chemistry. In fact, the ocean is named after him. It's called the Canfield Ocean. Right, Don Canfield slept on my sofa, right? Right, thank you. We sold the sofa, though, not realizing that he would be the first member of the National Academy of Science in our cohort, and the only one to date who slept on our sofa. So, anyway. So there are other models for other possible electron acceptors, and exactly what was the chain of causality from the atmosphere into the rivers and the shallow oceans and the ocean chemistry from which the sediment deposited. But whatever those conditions were, as Carl Sagan said, if it did happen, it can happen. It did. Banded iron formation exists around the world. After the sediment layers were formed, they were incorporated in whatever else went on for about 1.8 billion years in terms of geology, including being crunched up in mountain building events and folded and so forth. And that's why Jasper Knob actually has all these folds in it. These are folded sedimentary rocks that have been structurally distorted by structural geologic tectonic phenomena. So they're not in exactly the same arrangement and state that they were when they were deposited. There have been modifications since then. Those modifications include things that show up on a geologic map of Michigan. The lower peninsula is one kind of geology. The upper peninsula has a lot involved in tectonics of folding rocks and folding rocks into very tight structures. And here in the dark red on this map are the iron-bearing rocks in the various iron ranges of Michigan's upper peninsula. They are where they are because the conditions were right to form them at the time that those rocks and their immediate surroundings formed, and because even though there were some modifying processes that happened afterwards, those modifying processes did not destroy the naturally enriched concentration of material that had many, many tens of percent iron in it and only one other major thing to get rid of. So there, at any one time, this not very, looked better on my mounted monitor. The various mining areas of the Lake Superior iron ore mining district, including the Tilden and Empire mines near Marquette, but they're also Republic, Ishpeming, some of the other regions around. I was asked to say a little bit about the context of the Lake Superior region in the overall matter of iron, the iron industry in the world. It's remarkably hard to find a map like this online. This particular thing isn't my research specialty. I actually put this entire PowerPoint together since breakfast this morning. I haven't actually taught this particular subject before. Oh, this is going badly. It's really hard to find a map of where the actual ore deposits are. For some reason, no one publishes those. I found many, many mining company websites where they show you where their mines are. But there's no one map with all the mines of all the mining companies on it. So the simplest map I could find was one just about in 2008, a slice in historical time, human history, where how was the distribution, production of iron ore distributed around the world. Brown means the most. China produced a lot and consumed a lot. Australia produced an amazing amount and didn't consume any of it. They exported it all to China. The reds are places in emerging economies where they're starting to develop their iron ore deposits, Russia, India, Brazil. And some of the other shades of peach and orange and whatever those colors are places where either the deposits were originally smaller or by 2008 had been largely depleted and these weren't any more the main producing areas for iron ore in the world. The brighter colors largely reflect the more recently recognized deposits that are in early stages of being exploited. The blue line here, iron content and the gross tonnage, about 50 million tons per year has been US production in this particular time slice from 1990 to 2004, and it's been pretty flat. On the other hand, emerging economies like Brazil in the maroon lines, or China in the blue lines, or Australia in the green, all have been increasing production since 1990 because they hadn't had much before 1990. Whatever was there, they hadn't exploited yet. So there were other places in the world where the geological conditions were right, but not all of those places in the world were exploited starting at around the same time. The United States production has exceeded US consumption for all of history, all of recorded the history of mining. We have more than enough iron to satisfy our iron industry. It's elsewhere in the world where the production is going up. A lot of this data is in tables. They're very ugly, and I didn't have time to plot them in a plot. Presently, the United States is not anymore a large producer because other producers have come online alphabetically. It happens that the top two producers have A and B at the start of the letters. Australia and Brazil are presently the largest producers of iron in the world. That is the combination of geologic forces and the human history of a region that results in, you know, when are ore deposits discovered and extracted and exploited and so forth, that gave rise to the distribution of the mining districts of the Lake, the Michigan part of the Lake Superior province. And with that, I will turn over the discussion to what happens to the iron ore next. So.
I hope you all saw the paper today with Edmund Fitzgerald. Sorry. Wondering what this is. Can you give me a guess? Great. I was given this years ago. I think it's very close to the Edmund Fitzgerald. I've had it down at my basement office for years. But one reason why I brought it is for a comparison of what an ore boat can carry compared to a truck or even a train. Sure, if the scales are exactly comparable, pretty close. And I believe I was looking for this before I came. believe, you know, there are about 700 truckloads per shift, or about 700 car train loads per one shift. And one of the really interesting things to me, I mean, I see trucks on the road all the time. Good-sized hauling trucks. And I see a few trains going by, especially on campus, you know? I don't see a boat going by. And most of us, unless you live in on the shore in Detroit or, you know, someplace like that, you might see the ships coming by. But most of the shipment, most of the movement of it, we don't see. Most of us don't see. I've had this happen a couple of times, but just this fall, a good friend of ours who grew up in Western Michigan, was born, you know, and then moved to DC and has worked there for quite some time, brought her son to look at MSU because, you know, he's I think 16 and, you know, really, and wants to get him, you know, thinking ahead. And so I was driving around campus, and one of the things I did is go by the geology department and said, look at that rock, that's iron ore. And this mother, who's very bright, first things out of her mouth were, we don't do iron ore anymore, right? Wait a minute. No. Come on. And so I had to go into, we really do, you know, after World War II, we're running out, but, you know, they developed the pelletizing process, and now we've got, I don't know, 75 to 100 years yet left, and they're still mining. It's down a little bit this year, and, you know, because of economics, but, you know, we're still mining. And I really had to convince her. And most people, I think most people in Michigan don't notice it. Unless you're from the UP, you know, or you're by a shoreline. And that's well, I just have to say that's graded on me. Very bad. So I got into a, I think, a lecture, you know, driving around campus, extended. I think I finally convinced her, anyway. I have a couple of handouts for you. Actually, you know, John didn't give me much direction on what I should talk about. Or I wasn't listening. I don't know what it was. But, you know, I think I'm supposed to be talking a lot about shipping, but there's more to it. This is a picture I came across recently. I've got some, hopefully enough copies to pass around. But, you know, it's in the mine itself, one of the trucks. And here's a minivan over here in the corner, yeah, for scale. And I've got a recent Great Lakes Seaway Review piece on the other side of this. But if I get too boring, that's something you can take a look at. Another recent article, actually in the Great Lakes Seaway Review, but about lock closures and shipping down. The locks were down twice this spring and early summer. Not for a real long period, but enough to show their vulnerability. This is, you know, I think, like Devin Fitzgerald, a 720 person. 729 was the length of the Fitzgerald. But We've got them 1,000 footers now. I think there are 11,000 footers that are the prime movers of the iron ore. And there's only one lock that can handle that. And that's the Poe lock. And that was down for a short time. The other lock was down for a little longer. But there's been a lot of concern about what would happen if locks are getting really quite old. In the 50s and 60s, mostly of the technology. It's not new technology. It's a big door, a big gate, they close. I mean, you let the water in, and the boat comes up, and then going the other way, you put it in, you let the water out, and the boat goes out. It's a wonderfully simple technology. But there's been quite a bit of concern, I've heard anyway, had a fair amount of contact up at the lock itself about, you know, what would happen if there was a significant outage or some mischief of some sort. And interesting, they really haven't talked about that very much. I think in my PowerPoint I've got a great picture of, you know, a fellow with a rifle guarding the locks during World War II, you know. But I picked up on the sense that the people working up there, the Corps engineers, people who are working at the locks, have been hesitant to say too much because it would draw attention to this little, you know, little tiny passageway with locks. And yet they're starting to come to a point where they're talking to politicians, talking to, you know, Congress about getting more money to build another lock. They're starting to open up because they do see the vulnerability. And they're not hiding it from anybody, you know, that it's that way. But they want to get a backup lock. I think there's a significant attention going to that. I have a short PowerPoint. Actually, I put this together a couple years ago, and well, that's not it. Okay. Do I go to this screen? I feel really behind.
You can play anywhere you want.
I can?
Yep, this is the front.
Okay.
That goes that way. That's forward, the one on the right.
Invited up to the locks. A really interesting thing. I was born in northern Minnesota. Aunts and uncles, because my dad and his brother both worked in the mines for a little bit, and then they got out, but I've had a number of my one cousin work there for many, many, many years. Moved to Toledo, you know, on Lake Erie, big stuff going there. But when we would go up as a family, way back, we'd go up over the bridge, you know, and head west, immediately. Turn left, head back to, you know, relatives in northern Minnesota in an old family log cabin. It wasn't until, I think, 3 years ago, it is because I had a project with the Corps, and, you know, that I actually kept going north over the bridge and went to the Sioux Locks and went to the Sioux and went over the bridge to Canada even. I mean, you know, it was like, I've traveled around a lot, but I've never been there before. And I really, really, really enjoyed it. I've been there back several more times and plan to go back some more. But this, well,
And it's interesting, they like to call them boats, not ships, you know, internal, they call them boats. This is the picture I was suggesting, protection during World War II of the locks. More, there are more armed forces stationed at the locks than any other domestic location during World War II. It's a great book on the locks. Only more ore will win the war. But look at the size. That's most of my family. But the size of the, you know, this is one of the smaller ones now that they put out at the viewing site, at the viewing, you know. One driver said to me, my God, it feels like I go up those steps and I'm going up into my upstairs bedroom and I'm going to drive my house away. And this was an experience I had at one of the, actually in Hibbing, Minnesota, overlooking, you know, the mine, and I was there with my wife and my family, and we're looking, and they're at the lookout station, and it's a big pit, Hibbing, but you can see some of the trucks moving on the other side, and this gentleman started to explain to his, I guess, significant other that we don't do iron ore anymore. Those trucks are just moving there for us to see them, just as tourists. And my wife had to get in between the two of them. What? Are you kidding me? You know, you ought to be over there. But that perception and that, you know, it's really. Well, we are still losing quite a bit. This is back in 2012. We've dipped a little bit, but it's going to come back. There's lots going on in the world right now. In 1950, we were producing, the U.S. was producing, and really almost exclusively, except for a little bit out west, you know, Michigan and Minnesota were producing 40% of the world's iron ore. Right now, we're producing 2-3%. Not that it's gone down, it really, really hasn't. It's everybody else is you know, especially China, and the rapidly developing countries, you know, are using all kinds of iron ore to build the infrastructure, to build the bridges and the buildings and the rebar in the concrete for roads and, you know, all of that. But we're doing about 40, roughly, another at least 10 out of Michigan, almost 25 out of eastern Canada, so close to 75 million tons. It's not big compared to the world, but it's been a pretty constant. And we're in a whole different economic development phase than certainly than China or Brazil, you know. Soviet Union has slipped back and needs a lot of rebuilding. So, plus there are new projects. Yes, question.
What's a long tunnel?
It's longer than a regular tunnel. It's 2,240 pounds rather than 2,000. And I'm not sure why. Maybe
metric ton. It's a 1,000 kilograms.
These are some new projects that are coming along that are developing. The magnetation one especially is interesting to me. It's Larry Lettinen, another Finn up in northern Minnesota. He worked in the mines. He was at, you know, pretty high level on some of the mines and broke off on his own. And he's taking the tailings from the mines now and regrinding them and reworking them and with very high-powered magnets, starting to pull the iron out of those. He's got three different operations going right now. They're not real big, but it's kind of one of the newer technologies. And to me, it's really interesting, and I wish I could put this into a good graph and a real substantive part, but after World War II, there's a boom. You know, once the pelletizing process was secured, I guess, you know, there was a boom and a growth. The 80s, the 1980s, 81-2 recession, and then a slow, you know, really hit the mines hard. Employment was cut in half, even though they were still having to produce about as many tons. And I wish I could really document somehow, but I think it cut out so much of the innovation. And it was just, they were just producing then for many years. You get to 2000 and, you know, prices started to go up because China was buying everything they could. And, you know, out of Australia and Brazil especially, and most of the Chinese ore is pretty low grade, so they needed. But the price went up from $25, $30 a ton that it had been for the last 25 years anyway, around that, 30 at the most. You know, it went up to almost $200 a ton for a while. There's such a demand. And I think that started to bring on new innovation. I mean, there's going to be some new innovation mines that are, you know, too high priced that may come down, but it really sparked a whole new growth period in thinking about iron ore. And not everybody, but as I was saying, but the people that are connected to it. And so I think we're in another phase. Right now, the price has dropped back down some. China is, you know, they've slowed down slightly, but there are more countries that will be developing and needing to have a lot of steel to really build their foundations, the next phase. The third phase of development is what's going to be surprising. I mean, that's going to be Africa, you know, all of that solar energy, South America. I mean, who knows what's going to happen there? Okay, so that's too broad a brush. I quit.
I think I've got it. Well, thank you, John, and Michael, wherever you are, thank you for inviting me to participate in this. I should mention that John is my neighbor, and when he approached me to participate in this, I thought I better agree to it because he literally knows where I live. So I thought, there's no way I'm going to get around this. Those of us who are old enough, and I certainly qualify here, know that everybody remembers where they were and what they were doing at the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And the impact of the Edmund Fitzgerald was more regional, certainly. But many of the people living in the Great Lakes area, and especially in the Western Great Lakes area, remember the moment when they heard about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. I'm from Minnesota originally, like Peter. And my parents, my parents lived in Duluth, Minnesota in 1975. I was living in Minneapolis at the time, but I happened to be up in Duluth visiting them and on the 10th, on November 10th. And I don't recall hearing the news broadcast. It actually started late that evening when there began to be word that something had happened out on the lakes. So I didn't hear about it that night, but the next morning, getting up and getting the newspaper, discovered that there were news articles about the apparent demise of the Fitz. And in Duluth, which is certainly the major port city on Lake Superior, and a place where the Fitzgerald had gone under the aerial lift bridge and through the ship canal many times, the news was absolutely shocking. And I have to say, this is not the Fitzgerald. It was the only good aerial bridge photo I could find. But this is the Arthur M. Anderson, which actually played a fairly important role in the Fitzgerald episode as well. I work for the State Historic Preservation Office. And we maintain the official archaeological site file for the state of Michigan. And that means that we keep the record of sites that have been recorded in the state. And Michigan contains over 58,000 square miles of land surface. And we have over 22,000 land archaeological sites recorded. But a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there's also 38,000 square miles of bottomlands, Great Lakes bottomlands, that are also state land and part of the state of Michigan. There are archaeological sites on those bottomlands as well. And most of those sites are shipwrecks. Based on documentary records, we think there's maybe, roughly speaking, 1,500 shipwrecks in Michigan waters. That doesn't include your rowboat and your skiffs, that sort of thing. These are the larger commercial sorts of vessels. And probably something less than a third of those wrecks have actually been found and identified. The history of the loss of watercraft on the Great Lakes goes back undoubtedly hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, before the arrival of Europeans, certainly going back to the loss of birch bark canoes, native-made dugout canoes, and that sort of thing. The demise of LaSalle's sailing vessel, the Griffin, in 1679 marks the loss of the first sailing vessel in the Western Great Lakes region. Since that time, a vast array of different types of vessels have been lost on the lakes, everything from schooners to whalebacks and barges and scows and propellers and every kind of vessel you can imagine. But tonight we're really talking about lake freighters. These are the vessels that are designed to carry bulk cargoes, things like limestone, coal, grain, and in particular, iron ore. The bulk carrier that's recognized as the first of its kind on the lakes is the R.J. Hackett. The R.J. Hackett was built in 1869. It was only 211 feet in length, but its design with its open holds was a real step in the direction of bulk cargo carriers, and the Hackett was really the first to do that. By the first few years of the 1900s, there were lots of vessels on the lakes that were 600 feet long and more that were transporting iron ore from Lake Superior to ports all over the Great Lakes area. And today, we have, as was mentioned earlier, 1,000 footers. This is the Paul R. Tregurtha. The Tregurtha is the largest of the lake carriers at 1,013 feet 6 inches, if I'm not mistaken. The Tregurtha is a big boat. Since the latter part of the 19th century, I was talking to Wayne Lusardi, who's our maritime archaeologist, the other day. He keeps a database about this sort of thing. He tells me that roughly 140 bulk freighters have gone down in Michigan waters. The vast majority of those went down in the first half of the 20th century. Over the last 60 years or so, the wreck of a big lake freighter is an exceedingly rare occurrence. Certainly this is due to safety precautions, it's due to better weather forecasting, a whole host of reasons, but it's also because there aren't really that many lake freighters on the lakes these days. Between the U.S. and Canada, there's something on the order, roughly speaking, of about 50 lake freighters on the lakes. The Edmund Fitzgerald, as I think John mentioned, does lie in Canadian waters. It's not in Michigan waters. It's just across the border to the north, outside of Michigan waters. But that's the most recent loss of a lake freighter that we've had on the Great Lakes. And that wreck, of course, took place 40 years ago. In Michigan waters, only three lake freighters have gone down since the 1950s, which is part of what makes these sorts of events so shocking. Prior to the Edmund Fitzgerald, the most recent wreck was the Daniel J. Morrell. The Morrell was launched in 1906. It was 580 feet long. Went down in a storm in Lake Huron on November 29th, 1966. And 28 of the 29 crew perished. Dennis Hale was the only survivor of that wreck. And Dennis actually passed away just a few months ago. But Dennis spent a lot of years talking about that and doing presentations and telling people about his experience being the sole survivor of that wreck. Before that, the Cedarville, launched in 1927, went down in 1965 in a collision on Lake Huron, May 7th, 1965. 10 of the crew of 35 perished in that wreck. And it's interesting to look at the causes of wrecks on the lakes. Storms are certainly a factor, but it's surprising how many wrecks occurred as a result of collisions. The Carl D. Bradley, launched in April 1927. Bradley is 639 feet long, sank in a storm in Lake Michigan. November 18th, 1958, 33 of a crew of 35 perished. Shipwrecks are, of course, an attraction and a destination for scuba sport divers. The number of wrecks and the variety of wrecks and the preservation of wrecks in the cold, salt-free, shark-free waters of the Great Lakes make recreational diving a really popular recreational activity. But shipwrecks are also archaeological sites. Sites that hold information about vessel architecture and vessel technology, hold information about Great Lakes shipping and commerce, and also hold information about the lives of those shipboard who worked on those vessels. Shipwrecks are truly a time capsule variety or type of archaeological site. Everything on any given vessel went down all at the same time. And from an archaeological standpoint, this is something that is of particular interest to us archaeologically. You have a very precise moment in time for everything, the vessel itself and everything on the vessel, which makes these particularly interesting archaeological sites. Like every archaeological site, it's crucial to protect the integrity of shipwrecks and preserve the information that they hold. And to achieve that goal, Michigan established the Great Lakes State's Bottomlands Preserves and established as well the Michigan Underwater Preserve Council. There are 13 underwater preserves around Michigan and the Great Lakes. That includes Thunder Bay, which is actually a federally designated National Marine Sanctuary, but it's also a state underwater preserve as well. That's up in Alpena. There is a very nice facility up there. If you've never had a chance to see it, they have a really great museum. It's been relatively recently established, and the NOAA Sanctuary is actually a great place to visit if you're interested in shipping and shipwrecks. The preserves and the Preserve Council are dedicated to the protection and the preservation of Michigan's Great Lakes shipwrecks and to the education of divers and non-divers alike on the history of Great Lakes wrecks and the importance of preserving those wrecks. There's something inherently compelling about shipwrecks and shipwreck stories. In the Great Lakes region, shipwreck stories tend to be about spectacular storms and the power of the Great Lakes, but there are also stories of miscalculation and human error, sometimes on calm seas and in clear weather. Whatever the circumstances, these are stories of tragedy, stories of miracles of survival and rescue. Today, the tangible connection to those stories are the shipwrecks, which, on one hand, lie in silence on the lake bottom, and on the other hand, are eloquent in what they tell us about those stories. Thank you.
Panel members will now join me up here. I almost feel like we have to put Peter's a boat underwater for this discussion. Yeah, close to water at least, yeah. Right? When you see them beating microphones, it is not normally a good thing. But I think we're fine. We've come along. Why don't we work off of just the two that we still have? Okay? Either way.
While we're waiting, I'm always ready to fill vacuums of silence. I just want to make two remarks. Some of the figures in the talk and some of the topics that have come up in the various presentations are available to you in a book called Michigan Geography and Geology. It's a textbook that's used widely throughout the state. It's edited by a couple geography profs and a geology prof. Dr. Danita Brantenback was co-editor of Michigan Geography and Geology, sources some of the figures. And I brought several samples of banded iron formation, and I'll be happy to meet people at the back table to answer any questions about them. So,
great. Well, tell you what, I'm going to switch you. Okay.
John.
Now, we want to open it up for questions, and I think that anything is fair game. You know, that personally, I've spent a good amount of my time actually looking at one group of workers in the iron ore trade, specifically the people who had responsibility for trimming out the vessels in the late 19th century, early 20th century. I want to commend to all of you that Tom Volkanen has done a wonderful job on a book exhibit on the third floor here at the library. And we currently have our exhibit, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, over on the ground floor of the MSU Museum, which is not open this evening, but I do invite you back to see it. In both of those exhibits, Cindy Hunter Morgan, who's in our audience tonight, has two poems in each of those exhibits and has a forthcoming manuscript called Harborless that is going to be coming out from Wayne State University Press of Great Lakes Shipwreck poems. Which she read many of them recently at a reading at the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. And I commend her work to you in both locations, so please do check that out. But at this time, we have microphones set up. Now, the nice thing about those microphones is that way you get recorded, because if you only yell out your question, the problem is that we don't know, we can't necessarily hear you. These, as I've often pointed out to my students, these hearing aids I wear are not a fashion statement. They actually do have reasons for being. So if you have a question, please do go to a microphone at either end of the room, and we'd love to take on any questions that you might raise about iron ore, shipping, shipwreck, or to whatever degree we can about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Danita.
If we could get a word in edgewise. No.
Here we go. Okay.
My question's for the state archaeologist. I'm not from Michigan originally, so this wasn't part of my culture growing up. Who was Edmund Fitzgerald? Who were all these guys that the boats were named for? And why aren't any of the boats named for women?
I'm not exactly sure who Edmund Fitzgerald was, but I believe that a lot of these vessels are named for heads of companies and prominent executives in companies, and that may have been the case with Fitzgerald, although I'm not sure about that. And I know that in some cases I've seen vessels that were named for the individual who is at the head of the shipping company when they built the vessel, and a few years later, he's out the door, and they rename the vessel for the new executive who comes in. So I know a lot of those vessels are named that way. There also are lots of vessels out there that aren't named for those individuals. I'm thinking of some of the planetary things like the comet and the meteor and some of those, and place names like the Nipigon and lots of different things. So that's my understanding of those individuals' names for the most part. Why they aren't named for women, I don't know.
Well, there are a couple named for women.
Oh, okay, because isn't there a superstition that a woman aboard a boat was bad luck, and I thought maybe that had anything to do with it or not.
Mm.
Now, in the history of Great Lakes shipping, however, there were a number of situations where captains' wives were on the same vessels with them, often serving as cook on those vessels. So there are examples, at least in the Great Lakes, of women on Great Lakes vessels. And do hit a microphone, because that way we hear you.
Just a little comment about women on Great Lakes vessels. My experience is that the officers on the Great Lakes vessels, captain, first mate, second mate, third, chief engineer, 1, 2, 3, if the ship had facilities, were permitted to bring their wife aboard for if they were got out on Detroit or Toledo or someplace, they could go up above and come back. And they were nice entertainment for a while. I was in one circumstance where the wife of a third mate used to spend time when the third mate was on watch in the captain's cabin.
Ah. Shades of naval gray. Over to you, Jim.
Jim Anderson, Department of History. I was very intrigued and encouraged by a couple of things that Mr. Kakalot told us. One is that there's 75 to 100 years of usable, mineable ore left up there in the Upper Peninsula, and that can be mined. I was also linked to that. I'm very intrigued by your little chart of the new projects in North America, and you listed six, I think, companies I don't know that these are research or production projects or some of both. I think some of both. My question is, are any of those six companies or projects in Michigan? It looked like several were in Minnesota, from what I could tell. Could you clarify us on that?
There are several in Minnesota, and there are several in eastern Canada as well. Boy, the new projects in Michigan are more non-iron ore. I think there's non-iron ore.
Non-iron ore, like the copper sulfide?
Yeah, yeah.
In your opinion, is there still mineable, usable ore in Michigan subject to some technological innovation?
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe our geologists would care to weigh
in. I would also nod and say yes.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a question over to the left.
It's all about the money. From a geologist's perspective, what's the distinction between hematite and taconite, and are they both used in the same bridge, automobile, stainless steel?
Hematite is a mineral. It's a naturally occurring material. Taconite is beneficiated, crushed up, ground up, banded iron formation with a binder of a clay mineral, a smectite group clay mineral, to hold it together. The pelletization makes it a lot more uniform in size. They're all, 15 millimeter, basically, diameter. It's much, much easier to handle material when all the pieces of it are the same shape and the same size. So that's my understanding. Of course, that's actually the post-geological part,
right?
The processing part. It's treated in that way to make it easier and therefore less expensive to move it. And there's very little. The trade-off is you've introduced a little bit of a different chemical material into the clay as a binder. But by the same token, there are other beneficiation processes involved that separate the silica, the jasper part. So the ore grade is somewhat higher for taconite than it would be for a bulk volume of crushed up banded iron formation.
That makes sense. The other part, when you look back at the deposits, you know, we all know Michigan. And then you look at everywhere else in the world, which is huge. Not as good an ore, but are we limited by the locks in as much as a 1,000-foot boat, where when you look at some other countries, major expansions, major dollars thrown at the Sioux, at the Panama, and what that would suggest to me that they can bring ore in or grain or whatever they want from anywhere in the world far cheaper than what we'd be able to do because we're limited.
Well, yeah, I guess I care a little bit about it. You said it was all about the money. For many years, I would read the Financial Times every day of the week to find out why I didn't have money, and now I know why. But this was during a time of great, the 6 or 8 years I was doing that were a time of great turmoil in the iron industry, so even though I'll defer ultimately to Peter on that. Since we are nationally self-sufficient with respect to iron, we produce more than we consume. But most of what we produce, we consume locally. Issues of long-term shipping aren't necessarily that big a concern. We're a long way from international markets. It might not be worth it to try to build the Panama Canal and the St. Lawrence so one could handle, you know, bigger, Panamax and Capesize freighters because the shipping costs of going the greater distances to the main markets that would be available would be extravagant. I mean, China is the major importer of iron ore right now, and presently the Australians have all the advantages in terms of just being close to them, and India is trying to close that gap. So,
Peter, you want to jump on that?
the big ships, the 1,000-footers, really can't get out of the upper lakes. And that means also you can't bring in, you know, anything very big. The 730-footers, they can carry about 30% of what the 1,000-footers can carry. And what's moving on the oceans, you know, our 1,000-footers can carry about 70,000 tons. The ocean ships are enormous. They can carry like 400,000 tons. And to bring it first the distance by ocean and then downscale it to something that could come into the Midwest is just not practical. It isn't going to work very well at all. We're exporting a little bit outside, but mostly, you know. actually, I looked at this not too long ago. The iron ore. We used to mine iron ore in Rhode Island. Not so much anymore, you know? No, there's a little bit out west, but something over 98% of the iron ore comes from Michigan and Minnesota. And it comes, you know, down to the lower lakes, to Chicago and Gary and Cleveland and Toledo and Detroit. And this whole Midwest, I mean, we're really protected in a way, because of the distance and because of the difficulty of getting, you know, the ore in from there.
We
and I'll just add one more thing. When you look at the iron ore, it's a small part of, you know, the steel, and the steel is a small part of an automobile and everything else that we're doing in the Midwest. We still make some cars here anyway. But I ran the numbers on this and came up with about 5% of our total GDP is really dependent on iron ore and the Midwestern, how it builds, you know, in the Midwest.
Are you going to jump in?
I was just saying, if you want to try to write an interesting science fiction story, try to write how the U.S. steel industry survives after that 100 years of ore runs out and we have to start importing. Then some of these infrastructure issues will be critical.
There's other questions. I have one more.
Okay.
Is there a correlation between, because we're a big copper-producing region also, is there some correlation between where there's iron, there's copper?
No.
Oh, really?
Really.
Okay.
But one thing to say historically is that we were unbelievably blessed with, you know, one of the best copper areas of the entire globe, wonderful iron ore, unbelievable forests. You might remember that during the Toledo Strip War that Lucius Lyon, who was our territorial senator, said that at the conclusion of that war, when the 7/8 of the Upper Peninsula that was given to Michigan in exchange for Toledo, he said, "You have given us an area that is only going to give us the unbelievable wealth of bear meat and Indian blankets by comparison." And nothing against the city of Toledo, by the way, Peter. But I think that obviously he was grossly underestimating what white pine would mean to the state's economy, what copper would mean to the state's economy, what iron ore would mean to the state's economy. And one thing I think that Michael or Peter was beginning to get at, we were uniquely poised because of limestone along with everything else for the purpose of actually seeing the domestic steel industry rise up in Gary, Chicago, and elsewhere on the Lower Lakes. And it's just an unbelievably wonderful economic accident that all of those things converged into the miracle that became the Industrial Revolution here in the Midwest. And a lot of that is based on Michigan natural resources. So why don't we go, Jim, are you standing by that microphone for a reason, or are you just standing?
Well, it's a relatively trivial question, but toward the end of the panel discussion, reference was made to Thunder Bay as a location of several shipwrecks, and I was wondering if that Thunder Bay has any relation to the town of Thunder Bay in Ontario. Or if that is purely coincidental?
As far as I know, it's purely coincidental.
Okay.
Thunder Bay.
There didn't seem to be much proximity there.
Right. Yeah. Thunder Bay, Ontario is quite a ways up to the north, and Thunder Bay.
Right past Wawa.
Yeah. Where Alpena is a completely coincidental.
Oh, that's close to that Thunder Bay is close to Alpena.
Yes.
Different topic altogether.
Yep.
Thank you.
Over to you, Eric.
Just curious as to looking at the iron ore deposits that we have here. I mean, exactly what is it that, you know, why isn't it a little more homogeneous as far as the distribution, and what was the process that effectively, you know, protected those deposits? I mean, we're not that far away, but you can dig as far as you want. You won't, you know, find any ore here.
Yeah, that's a whole lecture and intro. Let me keep it shorter.
the condensed version.
Let me try,
please.
An interim, you know, if we needed a modern analog for a place where I guess Canfield got the idea of the Canfield Ocean, a place where you could study in a modern large body of water this whole issue of the oxidation reduction chemistry. It's places like the Black Sea and the Dead Sea. It's deep, relatively large, but relatively confined bodies of water where other processes like the decay of organic matter can use up all the oxygen and then create those reducing conditions under which the iron is soluble. These were probably, the banded iron formations were not accumulated in, you know, Bahama Banks-like big, broad oceans. They were probably in restricted basins that existed because of things like, you know, block faulting, dropping the bottom of the crust down below sea level so there'd be an elongate but relatively narrow sea like the Black Sea, the Dead Sea, rather than the open ocean. So where combinations of crustal forces in the Earth's crust would create those kinds of places where there could be down-dropped places for semi-isolated and deeper bodies of water, those would be the kinds of places, especially late in the game. There was one little peak about a billion years ago of just a little bit more banded iron formation forming. All of those were in locally restricted basins. So 1.8 billion years ago, those existed in certain places. They didn't exist in the place that later became the Lower Peninsula that had a different structural geologic history of how it deformed, was covered up with different materials.
Now, Michael, just one question that came up before. So are those same kind of conditions at all? I mean, because of the fact that the copper body is so close to iron, are those same conditions of the basin you've talked about responsible perhaps for copper formation?
Not really. Our copper deposits are only a little bit different from the world-class copper deposits elsewhere in the world, in the Andes and in the Rockies, where all of them are hot water associated with volcanic ancient volcanic activity, so-called volcanogenic hydrothermal deposits. So the hot water could dissolve copper, and as it moved away and cooled, it precipitated the copper out. There are also matters of how, you know, plate tectonics worked. The volcanoes tend to be where plates come together, and there's volcanic activity, whereas in Michigan, both in more ancient times, prior to and possibly during banded iron formation time, and during the whole copper episode, there was the so-called rifting, extensional tectonics with downdrop blocks. But even in that case, although they are not sulfides, it's native copper in the Upper Peninsula, but it's still associated with all the volcanic rocks of the Keweenaw region. However, those are about 700 million years younger than our banded iron formation. Now that 700 million years, 0.7 billion, is longer than the time since the first trilobites crawled around in the bottom of the ocean in the Cambrian. I mean, so we think of all of the macroscopic fossils, the corals and the brachiopods and the trilobites, and we go, you know, journey to the beginning of time. About 550 million years ago, nothing was making hard shells yet. It was 700 million years ago. I mean, that's 700 million years is a long time. Right? There was a big gap in time between the last banded iron formation in the Lake Superior region on the one hand, and the formation of the basically volcanic associated.
So the iron ranges were all sitting around thinking about the copper ranges like a new kid on the block.
Pretty
for
much.
The most part.
Pretty much. Pretty much. Sorry. Well, there were limestones that far back, but unfortunately, limestone is so soluble that old ones aren't preserved very much, right? Ancient rain of normal acidity would dissolve limestones faster than almost anything else. So.
Well, we have a question over on our right.
My name's Jim Howe. I'm kind of interested in the threats that possibly are happening with the locks. What kind of stuff do they do with the ships coming in from other countries? We just had a plane in Egypt just went down, and they're thinking there was a bomb on it. Couldn't a bomb be put in a ship and brought in? I'm addressing this to Peter. He was talking about.
Well, for me, it's all speculation.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying, I agree with what you're saying. It could happen, you know. There are a number of vessels going through there, some fairly modest vessels, but some medium, and there are the commercial ones going through. And I think that any one of them could be carrying a bomb. I really didn't think very much about that until the last probably 3 or 4 years, when really starting to look at the locks and with that talking with some of the people up there. And I think, and as I tried to say, I think what their approach in the past, they've always realized the vulnerability. I mean, certainly that picture of World War II, but they've tried to downplay it. And I think with the number of, and the one very recently of what, explosions, you know, the one that was in Boston with, I mean, you know, it doesn't take a fleet of aircraft to produce an explosion. And I think they're really realizing that, and they're starting to try to, I think one of the pushes for another lock is to have a backup. So
are they checking these ships before they come into our country?
I don't know that. I don't.
Let me just tell you that there is a mystery novel that was written about, I think, about 15 years ago, 20 years ago now, called Terror at the Sioux Locks, where a terrorist actually blows a ship in the lock.
Oh.
Okay. But remember that the Sioux Locks is not the only pinch point. So if you look at the gateway into Lake St. Clair, you know, there are a number of places that were vulnerable. And other historians in the room will tell you that Detroit was one of the destinations for German spies during World War II, and many of them were simply caught at the caught at the border, and were actually executed without much in the way of much fanfare. Michigan History Magazine covered this a few years ago, and I would commend that to you. So I think that there has always been a worry about what it meant to be the economic industrial engine of the United States, really, you know, both in terms of the arsenal of democracy in relation to Detroit, but also, as Peter showed you, with those wonderful men on guard at the locks during World War II, on how easy it is to actually bring a certain economic engine to a halt when you have a very important natural resource that no longer is available. Other questions?
I'll just follow up on that by saying that if you've ever been to this, and this is kind of to reiterate some of the Michigan tourism that has been talked about a little bit in the course of this evening's event, the UP is full of, like, each speaker, there's the national parks and Michigan parks, and the Sioux Locks itself is a wonderful place to actually visit in terms of tourism. And to the question of could you bring a giant boat in with bombs, I suppose you could, but they've been tracking those boats from wherever they've been. You know, when you go to the Sioux Locks, you get to see that there's a map, there's an electronic map with every boat and where it's come from, and how, and you can track it as it goes to the locks and as it goes through the locks. I mean, this is very sophisticated stuff. Hard to imagine that when those boats are loaded, they're not completely inspected wherever they are. I mean, I'm just saying that there's a lot of surveillance that goes on in the Great Lakes, especially for the big freighters.
Well, I love the fact when I heard about the copper episode, I automatically want to believe that somewhere, you know, there was a famous Duluth strip search of an entire vessel, perhaps, in the harbor at Duluth, based on the possibility of problems. But I think, Michael, that unfortunately, you don't have to bring a ship through the lock to close the lock down. You could easily come in from the side with different forms of explosives or whatever. I mean, not that we're trying to create the the terrorist plan, but I mean that there is a certain fragility that does not necessarily have to have monumental Hollywood kind of pyrotechnics to be part of it. Other questions, especially about shipwreck rather than other stuff. We'd like to answer a couple more before we call it a night. I do believe we have one over here.
Yes, I had a question for the state archaeologist about the bottomland preserves. You mentioned diving, and I was wondering about how much a problem looting by recreational divers of historic artifacts is, and how on such a huge scale. I saw that map. How that's enforced?
Looting wrecks has been a problem for a long time, and wrecks are oftentimes seen as trophies of a sort, and taking souvenirs off of wrecks is something that sport divers have done for decades, if not beyond that. But I would also hasten to add that part of what the preserves and actually a lot of dive shops and a lot of charter captains and folks like that have been doing in more recent times is really a concerted educational effort to help people understand that if you take something off a wreck, it's not going to be there the next time you go there, and it's certainly not going to be there for anybody else to see. So that trying to keep wrecks intact, keep the artifacts in place, keep those wrecks as a place that everybody can get to and enjoy if they're divers, is really the main effort at trying to curtail that sort of activity. As far as really trying to do something about it from a law enforcement standpoint, there's too many acres of water and too many wrecks and too few conservation officers. So that's a very difficult thing to do. It is also true, though, that other divers do police themselves and their fellow divers. Mm-hmm. And again, charter boat captains and folks like that do try to keep an eye on these things. So there is, I think, a lot more awareness these days. And I think the situation is getting better. But are things still getting taken off of wrecks? I'm sure they are. But I think that situation is certainly improving.
Thank you.
Okay. Do come over to the microphone, please, if you would. And we have Jim over here.
Was the Edmund Fitzgerald overloaded? And in relation to that, does the wreckage give any indication of the answer to that question?
As far as I know, the Fitzgerald was not overloaded. The capacity of that vessel, as I understand it, was about 26,000 tons, and that's what it was at when it went down. From what I know about people who have looked at the wreckage, that hasn't really helped resolve anything. The theories about what caused the Fitzgerald to go down, probably most people in the audience have heard or read about these things at one time or another. Hatch covers giving way, hitting 7 Mile Shoal and tearing a hole in the wreck, in the vessel, I should say. Rogue waves, there's all kinds of theories about this. And as far as there have been ROV trips, remotely operated vehicle trips down to the wreck, nothing that I have seen or heard from anybody seems to shed any light on which one of those theories or some other theory might really solve that. There were, terrific winds and huge waves on that particular evening, and it was a loaded vessel. Lots of things could have happened. I think the captain of the Arthur M. Anderson thought that there was a point at which he thought the Fitzgerald hit something, He made a comment about thinking that it appeared that something had changed with the Fitzgerald just before it sank. But again, I don't know that there's any light shed on that, and the wreck doesn't seem to have helped that.
I would commend to you Cynthia Canty today on her program out of the University of Michigan public radio station was really looking at a brand new documentary that's being produced on the Fitzgerald that looks at all the years prior from the launch through the actual wreck of the Fitzgerald, and then in the 40 years since, what has happened to families of crew and everything else. So I think that, you know, that will at least give us a kind of an additional data point. The nice thing, I mean, frankly, the Fitzgerald has been a real source of a great amount of the shipwreck literature that's available. So Michael Schumacher's book on the Mighty Fitz, one printed here at Michigan State University Press called 29 Dead. I mean, there's a variety of different books on the Fitzgerald, and it's one of those probably iconic historic wrecks that's probably produced more single volumes about it than probably any other Great Lake shipwreck that I'm aware of. Help me with that, Dean. I think that I might be correct on that.
I think you're probably right about that. Certainly, I mean, all the attention from Gordon Lightfoot's song certainly, you know, contributed to the popularity or the knowledge of the wreck and the literature that's been produced on it, yeah.
But it's interesting to me how quickly, I mean, how the communication from the ship and the disappearance, what seems to be very fast. Something very significant happened quickly.
Yeah, it does from the circumstances. Again, the Anderson can see the lights, has the Fitzgerald on its radar, and loses the lights, and very quickly after that, they got into a squall, and the Anderson can't see the Fitzgerald's lights anymore. Still has it on radar, but then they come out of the squall, the lights are gone, it goes off the radar. It does seem like something fairly catastrophic happened, yeah. So again, in that situation, whether it was hatch covers going or whether they had hit something and put a hole in the vessel, it appeared that something happened pretty quickly.
One thing that we do have over at the museum currently in the exhibit is some of the last radio transmissions from the Fitzgerald. And also some video footage of the Fitzgerald on the bottom, as well as other information about the Fitzgerald. So I would commend that to you. Sir?
When the Fitz went down, did your folks eventually find out where it broke up compartmentally, where it was three sections, four sections? Do you recall? Or did it just break in half?
I believe the Fitzgerald's in two pieces on the bottom. So I don't know if it broke midships in half necessarily, but it is in two pieces on the bottom. I think
and one
is upright
inverted.
And one's, yeah, inverted.
Mm-hmm. Does your business unit have a dive team, a state team that goes out that supports you? Or?
No. we do have a maritime archaeologist who's stationed up at the National Marine Sanctuary in Alpena. And he's a pretty high-powered diver. He's a tech diver. So he's capable of a lot of things. And there are occasions where he does make dives on wrecks. I've gone out with him. I used to dive. I don't dive anymore. I stay on the boat and watch him dive. but he does do a certain amount of that. But most of the time, if that happens, Wayne Lusardi, the diver, our diver with the state, goes with state police divers. They have all the equipment. They have the boats, and oftentimes we arrange to go with them.
Thank you.
Okay, I see a question over here. And, sir, we're going to let you be our last question, and after any answers come from this question, please, at that point, let us thank this wonderful three-person panel. But your question, sir.
What if it's not a question?
Then I think that we're going to clap. No.
A dear friend of mine who's passed now, but he was the fleet engineer. His name was Norman Martinson for Inland Lakes up at here in Portland Cement for years. Then it became Lafarge, and they changed the fleet into Inland Lakes. And you saw the Alpena go through the That was one of their ships. But when the Fitzgerald went down, him being a fleet engineer had enough leverage from that to demand from the light carriers that every sailor got a survival suit. So from that point on, so that's my one good point. Mm-hmm. And one other thing he did was to supply or have them support the alcohol counselors in each port through the Catholic Church, and the light carriers then helped him fund that. So if your engineer got drunk, you could put him back on the ship and take him back home and try to get him dried out and not lose a valuable member of the crew. So anyway, that's my comment. Thank
you. Comments, gentlemen, on any of that?
John, a very quick question. Okay. At approximately what depth does she rest?
About 520 feet, thereabouts.
And she was how long, 740?
739, if I'm not mistaken.
And, I mean, the one thing that's, I think, fairly interesting just about the Edmund Fitzgerald song by Gordon Lightfoot is the fact that, you know, it has created, you know, certain things in the public mind that, you know, very well may be true, but are also, again, iconic, the idea that somehow Superior does not give up its dead, you know, and that the coldness of the lake, the, you know, being so close, you know, that to that depth. Comments on that, Dean, at all?
with regard to the cold and...
And giving up the dead and the fact that we don't necessarily see a lot of bodies from Lake Superior wrecks by comparison?
I don't know how much the cold has to do with that, to tell you the truth. There are certainly... We know that there are human remains on any number of the wrecks in Lake Superior, in other lakes as well. It may be that the depth of Lake Superior and the cold water in Lake Superior may have something to do with that, but I don't know that anybody's really quantified that or been able to demonstrate that it's particularly different from the other lakes. But that may be true, but it may also be part of the legend of the lake. I'm not sure about that.
Well, please join me in giving this panel a round of applause.